Okay, how old is the earth? I have... I was giving my mom a hard time the other day and said she was older than dirt, and she smacked me. How old is the earth? I've actually, as I shared earlier, I have actually been on both sides of the issue here. For my first year as a creationist, I was really trying to hang on to my ages and everything. And so the first thing I really found out there that seemed like maybe I could fit the old ages in there some way was the gap theory. We've kind of been talking about the gap theory out in the hallway off and on. But essentially the gap theory is this, very simplified. There's lots of different versions within the gap theory. But essentially the gap theory teaches this, that there's a long period of time between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2 of the Bible. And usually the stories go, they're kind of similar here, that Satan was thrown down to the earth. He was in charge of the earth for long, long periods of time. But then God came in and destroyed the whole earth underneath Satan by a flood. And that's what made the fossils, that's what I was always taught. That's why where we get the fossils and stuff like that. And then God came back and then recreated the earth. And then we had the literal 6 days from that point on. I had a lot of problems with that scientifically. It didn't really answer because... I believe 100% in a global flood. So if all these fossils were made back then, the global flood would have wiped them out to start with. So that didn't really make sense to me as a geologist. One of the biggest things, Terry, he's going to send me another article. He's worked about this on a lot. Actually, there's a lot of experts on the gap theory and day age theory in here you can go talk to. But one of the biggest problems for me, in the end, what it was, is there was lots of life and death in this idea before Adam sinned and introduced death into the world. The Bible's very clear. It's by Adam's death that sin, that death was entered into. By his sin, death was entered into the world. So that didn't work. So one day I was watching TV and saw this really smooth-talking man. And essentially it was what he called a day-age theory. And it was each day, each one of these days were long periods of time. Maybe instead of a little 24-hour period, they were like 1,000 years or even longer than that. And it was all based on the Big Bang, things like that. Well, as I began studying the Big Bang, even secular astronomers have a big problem with the Big Bang. The Big Bang's a big dud. And I realized if I based my theology on that, if the Big Bang did drop out from under us, then I had to rethink everything. One of the biggest problems I had, again, though, and I'm not going to go into it, this is it's not only Hugh Ross, but there's some other day-age people out there. In the end, what really convinced me, in the end, was like Terry was saying, for one thing, the day-age, especially Hugh Ross, does not believe in a worldwide flood. And as a geologist, I see flood everywhere. I mean, everywhere. You drive from Grand Junction to Albuquerque, and you're never out of floodplains. I mean, actually, anywhere in the earth, you're never out of the floodplain. You see all these monuments up here, beautiful rocks and everything. But whenever you see all these monuments, all these rocks stacked up, I know they're from the flood. They're a testimony of their tombstone. They remind us of the destruction this earth went through because of man's sin. That's how I look at them today. So anyway... I rejected that again because lots of life and death before Adam sinned and introduced death in the world. So I came to the conclusion, say, okay, let's approach it a little different way. Why don't I assume that the Bible's right, that it is a young earth, and let me look at the dating ways that we are using today to get these old ages that I grew up on, that I was teethed on. I grew up in Utah and a kid in western Colorado, and everywhere I went, every rock layer in Utah was actually, there was a little sign telling you how old everything is. Dinosaur museums, I lived in the dinosaur triangle. These dates were pounded into me. So I says, well, let's take a look at them and see maybe if there's problems there. I was always taught that they were very exact ways to measure things in school and in college. And so I decided to go back and look, and there's lots of literature out there on it. But I'm going to share where I am today and why. What does the Bible say about the age of the earth? Actually, I today call myself a historic earth creationist. I actually got this from John Morris. He got it from some other individual. I can't remember. But I really like that for myself because, really, I like to play with words. I can be an old earth creationist and a young earth creationist at the same time. And the reason I say that is this. So I believe the very first thing that God made out there was what? The earth. So it's been around right from the very beginning. It's the oldest thing out there. right? So I can be an old earth creationist if I want to. I'm a young earth creationist, but when I call myself a young earth creationist, that's comparing it to the old earth creationists, or usually evolutionary timelines and everything. So I really like what John Morris, in one of his writings, he likes this term historic, and that's what I've called myself today, because the only way I can get how old the earth is using the history of the Bible, the genealogies of the Bible. And that's where I get it today. I've taken all these other things that I used to, as a geologist, used to hang my hat on. I've seen the problems with them. And today, I rely on what the Bible says. So I'm a historic earth creationist. So let's look at the days of creation. The Bible says in Genesis 1:5, and the evening and the morning were the first day, and the evening and morning were the second day, the evening and morning were the third day, evening and morning were the fourth day, evening and morning were the fifth day, evening and morning were the sixth day. Every time, God always calls every day the evening and the morning. And then he actually puts the numbers with them, okay? First, second, third, and all that. And then on the seventh day he rested, we find out. In Exodus 20:11, God repeats himself. Whenever God repeats himself, you know he's serious. He wants you to take note. So what he does, he reaffirms his days of creation by, for in 6 days the Lord made the heaven, the earth, the sea, and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh. So we have all these verses right here, evening and morning. Now you look at God actually gave us the parameters for what a day was, right? By the defining the word evening and morning. Now, when I'm working at camps and things like that, when I have time to work with larger groups, with a little bit of time, even VBSs, before we go into this age of the earth thing, the first thing I'll ask the students is I'll say, I want you to tell me what a day is. What is your definition of a day? And they'll say, okay, we get up in the morning, we go to bed at night, and we get up in the morning. That's a 24-hour period, that's a day. Right? Or a period of light and a period of dark. 24-hour period is what they come up time and time again. Well, that's how God does it right in here. Evening and morning was the first day, the second morning. He gave us the parameters. He defined what a day was, a period of evening and morning. Now, the Bible uses the word yom, the Hebrew word yom for day. Now, almost all the time, not always, there are exceptions. There sometimes it could mean more than a 24-hour period. But when you put it in context that I'm going to show you here, it always means a 24-hour period. I actually got this from Dr. Henry Morris, his study Bible. The day plus a number. Whenever the word yom is used with a number, and it's used 359 times outside of the creation account, it always means a literal 24-hour period, a literal day. Whenever the word evening plus morning together without the word day, 38 times used outside the Genesis account, again, it means a literal day, 24-hour period. Evening plus morning with the word yom, again, 23 times outside the creation account, it again means what? A literal 24-hour period. Night with the word day, with the word yom, 52 times outside of the Genesis account, it means 24-hour period, a day. So when you look at it in context, I'm pretty certain that God meant a 24-hour day, a literal day just like we see today. I can see no other way to look at it when he puts that much context around it. Now, yes, it can mean a long period of time, for as in the day of the Lord arrived. But that's an indeterminate time. But when he puts parameters like this around it, you know what he is talking about. So this is what I believe is a 24-hour period. And God has actually given us a way to figure out how old the earth is. When you read Genesis, if you have insomnia in here, now, I'm not ridiculing the Bible or anything, but if you have insomnia, a good way to cure it at night is just pick up your Bible and start reading Genesis 5. Start reading the genealogies in there, and they will put you to sleep in a very short period of time. But they are there for a reason, I believe. God gave us a clue to how old the earth is. Using this, and we're going to talk about some generations. Now, I assume that creation was year zero, and Adam was born born. He was created on day number six. So he would have been in that year zero, right at the beginning, at creation. The Bible tells us in Genesis 5 that Adam was 130 years old when he had Seth. So that would have been 130 years after the beginning, after that year zero. So we have 130 years after creation. Then Genesis 5, 6 tells us that Seth was 105 when he had Enos. So add that to his father, 130 plus 105, you get 235 years. So you continue to do that all the way. All these genealogies that God lays out right there in Genesis 5, you get down to Lamech as 182 years old when he had Noah. So that would have been 1,056 years after creation. And then the Bible tells us that Noah was 600 years old when the flood came. So add those up. The flood would have been 1,656 years after creation. Now that's assuming that these are all in place, there's none missing. There are a few arguments out there that there are some missing genealogies, but even if they are, we're not talking millions of years. The most I've heard is we could go up to, I actually read a report that said 12,000, I couldn't go that far. There are some information for 10, but I still lean. You know, God laid it out. God's the author of the Bible. And when he laid it out, so I'm very comfortable, well, I can use these genealogies right here and be pretty sure that they are in place. So, I'm going to say that that is 1,656 years using the genealogies. So we go from creation to the flood, 1,656 years. From the flood to Abraham was 300 years. From Abraham to Christ. Now, we're using generations in here, so these aren't real exact, but they're still pretty close. But now we've got from Abraham to Christ, 2,000. From Christ to present, about 2014. So we have approximately right in here, 5,970 when you do it in this manner. Right at 6,000. Now, again, some say up to 10,000. I can go 10,000. I don't know. I haven't seen enough evidence. I still lean very hard on 6,000 years for myself. But this is what the genealogies and the generations actually tell. What does science have to say about the age of the earth? Actually, quite a bit. They've actually done a lot of testing of different elements and everything out there. And that actually is kind of surprising because they actually come up with fairly young ages when you compare them to the radiometric dating methods that are used out there. But these are based, you have to be careful here because even some of them look fairly old. But you have to understand that these are all based on what we call uniformitarianism. That is, the present is the key to the past. So, we establish a rate. We look at a rate of change right today, and then we extrapolate that rate back into the past. We're going to look at that it's a pretty dangerous thing to do. But yet, we do it all the time. Or I should say, evolutionary scientists do it all the time. But even then, you see, many of the dates are a lot less than these billions of years, the radiometric dating method. And there's so much evidence for a young world. And I'm not here tonight to really go into a lot of those evidences. There's so many of them. I want to focus more on what's wrong with what we're being shown out there today. But there are a few out there. Humphreys, y'all know Humphreys, he's got evidence for a young world, and Morris has got the young earth. They've got lots of evidences in there that actually show young earth. I'm only going to share two of them with you here, just to give you an idea how some of these work. There's not enough mud in the ocean. If the oceans have been around for the latest figures in evolution for 200 million years, knowing the rate of how much gunk is getting thrown into our oceans today, and with a vast time period like that, if there are 200 million years old with how much stuff's being thrown in there today, there should be miles and miles and miles of mud on the ocean floors today. But there's not. At the deepest, we find only 800 feet, which actually points back to a young Earth. When we look at the salt content of the ocean, if the oceans have been around for as long as they say they are, knowing how much salt is going in and evaporation and everything today, you could almost walk to Hawaii today. Be a little spongy, a little soft, maybe all right, but you could almost literally, I figure out, walk to Hawaii with the salt content it should be. But it's not as salty as it should be if their ages were true. So again, evidence of a young earth. I want to tell you a story. You probably all know this story. It's a story about a frog. And we're going to make him personal, so we're going to call him Freddy Frog. Now, according to this story, Freddy Frog was picked up by this beautiful princess. Let me get that right. By this beautiful princess. And I don't know why she did this, but she picked Freddy Frog up and gave him a big smooch. And then what happened to Freddy Frog, according to the story? He turned into the handsome prince. Right? What do we call that story? A fairy tale, that's right. A fairy tale. But yet in our books today, In the secular books today, teaching our children, we have the same story with some added ingredients, and we're getting a different result. Well, not really a different result. We're getting the same result, but it's called something different. We have Freddy's Frog, but we add some Mother Nature, a whole lot of Father Time, little chance random accident. What do we get? Same result. We get the Handsome Prince. What do we call that story? We call that... No, we call that evolution. Actually, it is right. It is a fairy tale. But it, in the world, is called evolution. Now, by the way, I've had many people say that is science. That is not science. We talked yesterday about science. What science is. You have to be observable, demonstrable, and repeatable. Evolution is not observable, demonstrable, repeatable. Creation is not observable, repeatable, or demonstrable or repeatable. They're both philosophies. Evolution is a philosophy. It's not science at all. But here's the key ingredient right in here. Oh, they use a little random chance and accident in Mother Nature, but here's the key right in here. Father Time. When I used to believe in evolution, I used to argue evolution. And one of my main arguments is it's happening so slow, but so you can't see it. But given enough time, anything is possible. Given enough time, anything can change into something else. And I argued that all the time. But understand something. If you take time away from evolution, what's going to happen to it? The whole theory is going to collapse upon itself. So that is one of the holding on things they always have to promote, right, is the age of things out there. Because without it, evolution will actually collapse. Now, they have come up, some of them have come up to try to get around that. They have what they call punctuated equilibrium. We go through vast periods of time, nothing happened, then poof, chicken lay an egg, out come dinosaur, something like that, all right? And so that's an idea out there to try to get around, but that doesn't even make any more sense than the other one to me. But anyway, and I don't want to be critical. If anybody believes in evolution in here, don't get me wrong, okay? But really, when you look at how it's being taught out there, sometimes it just does not make sense, does it? Here's the evolutionary timeline, but don't hang your head on that first number of the Big Bang. When I graduated in 71, I was being taught at that time that the universe was anywhere from 13 billion to 15 billion years old. Now, recently, they pumped it up to 20 billion, but once they got the Hubble out there, the Hubble spacecraft, looking for the beginning of time and everything, they noticed that maybe they went too far. So now, like Walmart rollback prices, they start to roll the ages back. So now they're approaching 15 million again. I do not think in my lifetime I'll ever see them get to 6,000, but they are rolling it back at this time. The Earth, the age of the Earth has been around for a long time, pretty stable here at 4.6 billion years ago. What they consider simple life, there is no simple life, by the way, but what they consider simple life appeared 3.5 billion years ago, and we're actually a dot on this line. We've been only around for about 200,000 to 3 million years, according to evolution. So this is essentially the evolutionary timeline. Now, how can we tell how old something is? If I go out there and pick up a rock, can I actually tell just by looking at it how old it is? What about this lady up here? Is this an old lady or a young lady? How many of you, when you look up here, see an older lady? Raise your hand. All right. How many of you see a young lady? Raise your hand. How many of you don't see an old lady or a young lady? Raise your hand. And it's all right. Remember, we all look at the world through different colored glasses. We all see it a little bit different. Now, in reality, can this lady be old and young at the same time? Up here can, because this is what we would call an optical illusion. But in reality, she's either old or young. She cannot be both. And we have the same thing with the Earth. It cannot be old and young at the same time. It's either one or the other, isn't it? Now, before we go on and look into that idea, this is the older lady. This is her head. This is her hair, or scarf, I should say, up in here. Here's her head. This is her nose. She has a little bump on her nose right here, but this is her nose right in here. This is her eye. Down here is her mouth. This is her chin, and she has some fur. All right, that is the older lady. Now, the younger lady's kind of looking back over this way, kind of to your left. Again, a scarf, hair, fancy feather. Now you see the side of her head. Most of you saw her, but we're going to show it anyway. See a little bit of her eyelash, a little bit of her nose, her cheek, her chin, her jaw. And what was the eye of the old lady is now the ear of the young lady. And what was the mouth of the older lady is now the necklace on the neck of the young lady. How many of you still can't see the one you couldn't see before? And it's all right. I love all these looks. That's when I first saw it. I was like that myself, all right? If I let you watch this long enough, all of a sudden, I see it now, all right? But anyway, that era. And that's what we have out there today. How many of you recognize this chart right here? This is a geological time scale. As a secular geologist, this was my Bible for years and years and years. In fact, until I became a creationist, this was my Bible right in here. It essentially told me everything I had to know about evolution and the date, age of things out there. What it is we have all these drawings of these sedimentary rocks. Now, when I say sedimentary, we're talking about rocks, layers that were laid down by mud and water. Actually, down here, these are metamorphic igneous and metamorphic rock down in here, and what they call the Precambrian. But all these from here on up are all sedimentary rock layers. And then we have the ages. Beginning down here at the Cambrian, these are different ages, but this is 570 million years old right down here, up to modern day, we're up here in the yellow. Then over here, in these ages, they have all these little animals that supposedly evolved during that age. Involved from one type of animal into another, so we start with these sea critters down in here and get up to us, the land mammals, and us up in here. Now understand, nowhere in the world will you actually see these rock layers piled up one on top of another like that. Right? What we do, we find some of it here and some of it there, and then they try to correlate it to bring it into this. I really have no problem because some of these ages, we actually do find those particular fossils in that. I don't have a problem with that. What I have a problem with is this part over in here. One of the problems I always had, even as a secular geologist, is this Cambrian right down in here. This, you probably all heard about the Cambrian explosion. All of a sudden, bang, we have all this life appear out of nowhere, essentially. And this life, by the way, is very, very complicated. This is a trilobite right in here. Trilobites like I call them roly-poly, those little bugs you touch and you go up. This one kind of lived on the ocean. We know, I call him a roly-poly because they found this one in a defensing position, pulled, rolled up kind of like a roly-poly. But these things are highly complex. They found some of these trilobites out there have some of the most complex compound eyes that we've ever found in any animal, including the living animal. They're very highly complex, but bang, they're just there right from the very beginning. Where did this complexity come from? There was nothing before that, but yet, bang, they're right there. Cambrian explosion is one of those things that was always just a bug, you know, that just irritated me in the back there, because where did this stuff come from? As an evolutionary scientist, I really had a problem with the Cambrian explosion. But then again, all these ages up, right up through here. How do we actually date these fossils, though? How do we date them? I asked this the other day, and the lady said carbon-14. Is that the right answer? No. What about radiometric dating method? Is that the right answer? No, we can't date them that way. So how do we date the fossils? Here's how we do it. How are they dated? Well, I would go out. When I was actually going to college, my professor, I was having to do a lot of his field work because he had polio, so he couldn't get up into the high mountains and everything. So I was doing a lot of his field work. And I went out one day. We was actually over in Utah, and I actually found a trilobite. I said, wow, this is cool. So I took it to my professor. I said, professor, how does this trilobite? He took it. He took my trilobite, and he went through his books. It had all these pictures of trilobites until he finally identified the trilobite I had. He says, that's easy. He said, that trilobite's 570 million years old. I said, how did you know that? He says, because we know how the rocks are that you found that trilobite in. But how do you know how the rocks are? Because we know how old the fossils are that are in that rock. But how do you know how the fossils are? Because we know how the rock is. But how do you know how the rock is? Because we know how the fossils are. You see what I'm doing? Now, we're laughing, but I have to tell you, this is what is still being taught today. It is called circular reasoning. You use one to answer the other one to answer back on itself. It's very much like a dog chasing his tail. But now they have what they call the radiometric dating methods. Now, they can't date these layers here because these are sedimentary. They're the wrong type. But what they will do is they'll date like igneous rock in the location in here, and then they'll try to fit it in to see if they're accurate. All right, so now that's how they actually do it to give us these dates and everything. But they still cannot date the fossil itself. You can't do that with any of the test methods we know today. Radiometric dating methods, these are the three main ones. There's actually about six of them they use quite a bit, but these are the ones you hear about the most. Understand, all of these can only be used in igneous rock or metamorphic rock. And one of the keys you need to remember is this rock has to undergo tremendous amount of heat, almost to a lava stage. And the standard is when it cools, that's when the clock starts. Tick, tock, tick, tock, tick, tock. Doesn't matter how old the rock was before that, but as once it gets heated up and cools, that's when the clock actually starts, when the stuff gets worked around it. Right? These are the three main ones we see in the used out there in the world today. Rubidium, radioactive rubidium. losing energy over time and changing into strontium. Potassium, radioactive potassium, has high energy, loses energy over time, becomes argon. And the one you probably know about the most is uranium. Radioactive uranium losing energy over time and becoming lead. These are the ones that are used most today. But before we jump into them, you need to understand how every one of these and almost every dating method we use, how they actually work, the background behind them, the assumptions we have to make them work. I want you to imagine one day a scientist came home. And he noticed his son Tommy was in his bedroom picking up toys. Being very observant, he went and watched his son, and there was a clock on the wall. And the scientist noticed that every time a minute hand went by, Tommy was putting a toy in the toy box. He watched him for 10 minutes, and sure enough, every toy that went in, 1 minute had gone by. So he established a rate. And being curious, he says, I wonder how long my son Tommy has been picking up toys. So what would be a way he could figure that out? Count the number of toys, exactly. So he counts the number of toys in the toy box. He comes up with 29 toys. Now, he established a rate, one toy per minute, 29 toys, that's easy math. It took Tommy 29 minutes to pick up those toys. But is that a good answer? Well, it could be, but here's the problem. All the scientist knows for sure is what he observed during that 10 minutes. He has to guess about everything that happened before that time, before he came in. All he can really rely on is what he observed. He has to assume, for example, that Tommy was always picking up toys at the same rate. If he wasn't, his answer is going to be wrong. He has to assume he's always right, but that could be wrong. It could be that Tommy was doing a lot faster before his dad got home, but by the time his dad got home, he was tired, so he had actually slowed down. But the scientist doesn't know that. All he knows for sure is what he could observe during that 10 minutes. Maybe Tommy was doing it a whole lot slower before that point, but now, oh, wait a minute, this is much more efficient, so now he's actually doing it faster. But again, Tommy, or the scientist, doesn't know that. All he knows for sure is what he could observe during that 10 minutes. Maybe Tommy's mom had gone in the bedroom, picked up a whole bunch of toys, got disgusted with the mess, and made Tommy finally get in there and start picking up his own toy. So maybe there were already some toys in the toy box before Tommy even began. But again, does Tommy know, or does the scientist know that? All he knows for sure is what he could observe during 10 minutes. Maybe evil sister Susie. Now, if your name's Susie, all right, I'm not picking on anybody, all right? But maybe evil sister Susie came up and stole a whole bunch of toys while nobody was looking. But again, the scientist doesn't know that. All he knows for sure is what he could observe that 10 minutes. He has to guess about everything that happened before he walked in that room. And if his guess is wrong, what else will be wrong? If his assumptions are wrong, his answer will also be wrong. And that's exactly what we're dealing today. See, we can look at the rates of change in a rock today. For example, we can observe in a rock how slowly uranium is changing into lead. And it is a very slow process. In fact, they're telling us today the half-life. That means I have a lump of uranium. In so many years, it'll lose half the energy and change into something else. Only half of it will change. Now, they're telling us today that it takes half of uranium, 4.5 billion years, to change into lead. Now, do you see a problem here? Has anybody been around 4.5 billion years that you could observe to make sure that rate was always the same? You have to assume it is, because if it changed at all, what's it going to do? It's going to throw off your dating method, isn't it? All right? You have to assume, for one thing, when that rock was formed, or when it cooled, there was only uranium in that rock. If there was any lead present in that rock, that's going to what? Throw your dating method off too. Because remember, uranium changes into lead, so uranium is what we call the parent, and lead would be the daughter element right in there. You have to assume that. You have to assume over that long period of time, nothing leaked into it, nothing leaked out. But again, do we know that for sure? Were you there to observe it? No, we have to just guess that. Right? You also have to do this. You have to figure in the element concentrations, because what we've discovered is stuff is not always evenly spaced throughout rocks. It's not always what we call homogeneous. It's clumpy. Some minerals will be a little heavier here and over here, so they're not always evenly spaced. And that creates lots and lots of problems. Now, normally we can't take a really big rock in there. It's a very expensive process. So we just take small parts of the rock to have it tested. Now, if you take this rock here, take a small area of it to have it tested, for example, this area right in here, send it to the laboratory. They will observe there's all this uranium. And there's no lead. So all this uranium has not had enough time to change into lead. So therefore, what is this rock? It's a young rock. But yet in the same rock sample, you send another thing in. Over here, it's mostly lead, or lots of concentration lead. So they look at that and say, well, all the uranium has changed to lead, therefore this must be what? A very old rock. You see the problem we have in the same rock? Is it old or young? You can't tell, can you, all right? And this is the inherent problems we have with these things, all right? It's not the precision stuff we're always told. By the way, when I was working for my professor, I would gain samples and everything for him. He was working on his doctors, and he needed some ages on these things. So we were preparing the samples and sending the laboratory. The laboratory had actually spent a special sample sacks back to put the stuff in. And on it, they actually asked us this question: how old do you think this rock is? I never thought about it. It was easy. I'd just go out and get the USGS maps. I knew where I'd found it, and they had it all dated and everything for me, so that was easy. Oh, it must be this age right in here. Come back right in that area every time. I actually have a friend, he's still using, he's a consultant now, and once in a while he still has to do for some of these clients some of this dating stuff, and he has found out that it doesn't matter what date you send into him, that's the date you get sent back. And he actually challenged some of these labs one time. And he says, well, they actually admitted, say, well, we get lots of variation in this. We get many, many different multiple dates on the same rock sample. So what we want to know is where you're looking for, so we can see if we can fit you in there. It's a business. They're wanting to take care of their client, right? So you have to be careful. It's not the precision stuff that we always think it is. There's lots of problems with it. Understand what it is, because nobody can actually observe it other than in the future. You can't go back in the time machine. It's what we call a hypothesis or an educated guess. So this is how it should work, if it did work at all. So what should we do? Well, what we should do with a hypothesis, test it out. Use the scientific method. See, does it actually fit? Does it actually work? Well, that's been done. The Grand Canyon, we have all this sedimentary rock down in here laid down by mud and water. If you recall, you cannot date this rock right in here. But clear down to the bottom is the Precambrian. There's actually a basalt called the Cardinus basalt down in here. That's a type that they can date using radiometric dating methods. Also up on the top, there's a lava flow on top of the canyon that they can actually date. Now, they dated this down in here, the Cardinus basalt. Look at these models right here. Look at them. There's four different models that they actually used. And do you notice that none of those dates actually agree with each other? They're quite a bit different, actually. The same thing with the ones on the top. Those dates, the four different models they used, none of them actually agree with each other. They're very inconsistent. But then what they did is I think it was ICR that did this. You might correct me on this. But anyway, they tested this down in here. They got six samples, sent them to the laboratory, and had them test six samples using the rubidium strontium model. The laboratory came back after the test. They said, well, this rock down here is 980 to 1,100 million years old. 1,100 million years old. They sent five samples of the top stuff and had the same laboratory test, the rubidium strontium model. They came up, the stuff on top was 1,270 to 1,390 million years old. Now, you see a problem here? What did they just say? The stuff on top was actually older than the stuff on bottom. In other words, they said this stuff here that gets laid down first, and then this comes along, that this is older than the stuff down here. Now, this came first, so this is older, right? Ah, wait a minute. Unless it was laid like this and then flipped upside down. And now we can get that, can't we? Yeah, we can. But we're pretty sure that didn't happen. Why? Because when you look at the extent of the rock layers in the Grand Canyon, for example, the Chinle, this is the Grand Canyon area here. This is the Chinle Formation. It doesn't go feet. It doesn't go miles. It goes statewide, unbroken essentially underneath all these states right in here, been tested through wells and everything else. That huge area right in there. This is another formation, the Dakota Sandstone. This is the Grand Canyon here. It goes clear up into Montana, clear out into Minnesota. Colorado, it's underneath all of Colorado, even part of New Mexico. Look at the extent there. You look at the Morrison Formation, it goes almost to Mexico, clear up into Canada. Now, the only way all this could get laid down, one on top of another, then flipped upside down like a pancake, is the whole North American continent and most of the Central American continent is going to have to be flipped at the same time. And we're pretty sure there is no evidence that that happened. I think we would have seen evidence like that. We don't. But here's one thing we do see. This is not only on top of the canyon, it flows down the canyon, it actually flows over this down in here. So we know by the way it's situated that this has to be the youngest, but that's not what they came up with. The stuff is not the precision stuff we're always told. The volcano, actually a lava flow was tested using radiometric dating method. And they said, well, this stuff is anywhere, using these dating methods, anywhere from 140 million to 3 billion years old. Now, is that precision dating? I mean, I can throw any long date out there, and chances are it's going to fall someplace in there, isn't it, all right? And don't get me wrong, I don't want to mock this too much. I understand they get such variations, this is what they have to show you out there. Right? But that's wrong, because historically we had an eyewitness account that wrote that it actually flowed and cooled in the year 1801. It's only hundreds of years old. Not millions, not billions, but only hundreds of years old. Understand, it's not the precision stuff you always were taught. Now, many of you probably recognize this. I talk to a lot of young kids anymore. They don't know what this is, right? Because they weren't born yet. This is, y'all know what it is? Mount St. Helens, that's right. This is what Mount St. Helens looked like before 1980. But before 1980, Mount St. Helens took up a very bad habit. She began to smoke, which proves smoking is bad for you. Anyway, she began to smoke. She began to bulge quite a bit. And she finally bulged enough that there was a huge landslide. Almost a third of the mountain slumped off, hit a lake down here called Spirit Lake. Then all the pressures that were built up right in here blew not up, up a little bit, but mostly out. Pyroclastic ash flows, rubble and everything coming out at tremendous speed, sideways. Huge, huge volcano blow, actually two times. I usually have this up to sound. This wakes people up because I boom you out of here. But anyway, May 1980 and June of 1980, it blew up. And when those were done, one-third of the mountain essentially was completely blown away. And then 1982 was the last major explosion up there. And when after 1982 explosion, what we had was this hole, or what we call a caldera. This, by the way, was the Spirit Lake. This is where all the stuff actually slumped off, and then this stuff was blown out in that major direction. Now, 1982, after the last explosion, we had this molten lava dome start oozing out from the bottom. It's continued to grow where it's actually very much near the top today. Many are kind of considering it might get ready to blow again. We don't know, all right? But anyway, 1999. Some scientists in the Institute of Creation Research, if I'm correct, they went down, they got brave, and they took a sample of this stuff that began flowing and cooling in 1982 and had it tested. Now, how old should it be? Okay, and they had a sample sent in 1999. Rock had cooled in 1982, so it should be what? 17 years old. And by the way, we know we were there. This was this is Mount St. Helens right in here. This darker color here was the main fallout, the main ash stuff that was being thrown out, a tremendous amount of destruction and death. This is the lighter stuff. All of this was what was actually floating down the jet streams over the continental United States, Oklahoma. I was teaching some kids this the other day about Mount St. Helens. They said, well, they're teaching us about Mount St. Helens in science today. I said, what are they teaching you? That when it blew up, they had ash clear out in Pennsylvania. I said, what else did they teach you? That's all. It just blew ash that far out. Actually, it blew it farther than that. The jet stream saw it picked most of this up. And was even in the Virgin Islands, I had a report. Some people said it was down there. But we knew what was going on. Why? Because at that time, my wife and I were living in a small mountain town called Granby, Colorado, up near Rocky Mountain National Park, 8,000 foot. We knew it was going on. Why? Because for a week, for a solid week, every day we went out, we had ash from Mount St. Helens on our car. One day it was so thick on the windshield, we couldn't even see out. And you don't just scrape this stuff off. It's very sharp and angular. It actually scratches your paint and your glass and everything. So we were there. How many of you remember Mount St. Helens? You were there. So what did they test it? Using radiometric data methods, say anywhere from 340,000 to 2.8 million years old. Now please, be gentle to me. Do I look 340,000 years old to you? By the way, I never ask high school kids this. All right? No, we were there. But yet, this is what we find time and time again. The other one I hear about all the time is carbon-14. In fact, kids ask about carbon-14 and say they tested things with carbon-14 so they know how old they've been. So I have to talk about carbon-14. This is a very simplified version I'm going to give you here. We have this stuff called nitrogen-14 out in the atmosphere. It gets bombarded by cosmic radiation, changes into radioactive carbon-14, which then links up with the carbon dioxide that we're breathing out. The plants absorb it, and then animals eat and everything. So essentially, everything living has carbon, radioactive carbon 14 in us. Even if you only eat meat all your life, that meat you're eating probably ate plants, so it has a carbon 14. But essentially, what happens to us, we come to a saturation point where it can no longer take any in. But once we die, it starts changing back nitrogen 14, or think about leaking out. So they say, well, here's what we can do. We can take something that was alive at one time that has carbon 14, and we see how much carbon 14, so we can show how long ago it died. Not how old it is, but how long ago it died. Now, that's the hypothesis. So what should we do? Put it to the test. And it has been put to the test, by the way. This was actually by evolutionary scientists put this to the test. They actually took some mollusk shells. Mollusk shells are just a fancy name for a clam. They took some clams, had them tested using carbon 14. They said these clams died 2,300 years ago. Problem was, though, they forgot to tell the clams. Why? Because the clams are still alive. Guys, see a problem here? It's a huge problem. They had never died. They actually took a snail shell, had it shell of it. It was a living snail. They actually had it dated, the shell. They said it died 27,000 years ago. It was still alive. A freshly killed seal, they dated dying 1,300 years ago, that was freshly killed. But my favorite is Dima. Dima, they found up in Siberia, part of Alaska. Frozen baby mammoth. Using carbon 14, they tested her, and one part tested at 26,000, another test at 40,000 years old. How long could a baby dinosaur mammoth like that live? We're talking thousands of years in for one size to the other, right? You see a problem here? These dates, they're just, we have big, big, big problem with them, don't we? All right? We have the, we take things, we test, know the age of, or at least the relative age of, and we test them, and we don't get the right results. So what good are they for things we don't know the data? Do you think they're very accurate there either? They really do not work. They're not the precision thing. Now, carbon-14 has a short half-life, only 5,730 years, compared to uranium, which is 4.5 billion years. And so, but remember, you cannot use carbon-14 on rocks, only something that was organic that has carbon material in it. What does that mean? Well, we have a big hunk of carbon-14. In 5,730 years, half of that carbon-14 will be gone. In another 5,730 years, half of that will be gone. So in a very short period of time, you are left with such a minuscule amount that you can't really date it anymore. So they put a limit. Anywhere from 50 up to 100,000 years is as old as anything is that you can actually date. I'm going to use the median of 70,000, someplace right in between. So essentially, nothing older than 70,000 years should you be able to date using carbon-14, because there wouldn't be enough there left. It all would have been leaked back out or changed back to nitrogen 14. Well, I had the book out there called Thousands, Not Billions, and it was done a committee called the RATE, Radioisotopes in the Age of the Earth. And what they discovered is they was going back and looking at some of the geological reports of carbon-14 in the written literature. And what they discovered was there was lots and lots of claims that the scientists were actually finding undecayed carbon-14 all the way throughout the geological time scale. In other words, it hadn't had enough time to revert back, so there was still lots of carbon-14, undecayed carbon-14. What's that mean? Well, this line right here, flashing, we should find nothing, no carbon-14 below that red line. That represents 70,000 years old. But these reports were showing undecayed carbon-14 clear throughout the whole geological time scale. One report even back to what, to almost 570 million years ago. You see the problems here? They're just not working for some reason or another. They also dated something. They said, y'all know about diamonds, right? And I was taught as a geologist that diamonds were made about 1.5 billion years ago deep in the earth and brought up with tubes up to the top. So they're very, very old. Well, diamonds are made out of what? Carbon. So what they tested, had tested. Right? Now, if they're 1.5 billion years old, there should be no carbon-14 in it at all, should there? But yet it showed out there was carbon-14 in it. Now, they were smart. They didn't use their wives' diamonds. They used industrial diamonds, I think, all right? But it actually tested. A huge, huge problem. Again, that book out there goes into a lot more detail than I do. More evidence from Mount St. Helens. Up until 1982, this canyon you're looking at right here was not there. It's called today, they call it the Little Grand Canyon of the Toutle River. 1982, that last explosion, when they came out, all this hot material and everything hit lots of snow and ice, and it turned into mud. Began to flow, but then it got trapped, dammed up for a short period of time and built up until it broke or breached. And once it broke or breached over this dam, it came down and made this canyon right here in one single day. That's all it took. And this canyon, by the way, is 1/40th the scale of the Grand Canyon. You go upriver near the head where it actually broke loose. Now, what I used to believe about geology, I would have looked out on that, walked out on that point, looked down, and said, wow, it took a long time for that little stream or river down there to cut this big old canyon right in here. But I would have been 100% wrong. It happened in one day. All this rock right in here was what was laid down in 1980 explosions in May of June. This down here, though, was solid rock. It actually broke or breached right up in here. But to give you an idea of the scale of it, there are two people standing right there to show you the scale. 1/40th the scale of Grand Canyon, and it only took one day. See, time was not the key ingredient here. What was the key ingredient? Having enough material. Have enough water or mud, right, to cut this. That was what the key was right in here. You go down to the Grand Canyon. I was taught the Grand Canyon, classic textbook stuff. I finally got to go down there one day, right? But I knew everything about the canyon because what I was taught. And I was always taught that the Colorado River that goes right by my house in Grand Junction, by the way, it took millions of years to carve that canyon. I have a friend, his name's Tom Willis. I talked about Tom earlier. He was down there on a tour of the Grand Canyon. He's talking to one of the rangers down there that actually is a geologist. And he had on his Smokey the Bear hat, giving a talk to these people about the formation of the Grand Canyon. And he told Tom and the rest of the group, he says, today we are allowing 92 million gallons of water per minute to flow through the Grand Canyon because we believe that's very, very historical, and we're going to try to keep it historical so we don't damage the environment down there. So 92 million gallons of water per minute. And then the geologist went on to tell Tom and the group, he says, and by the rates of erosion and cutting today, we can then use that and figure out how long it took to carve the canyon. So from that, they got 18 to 31 million years to carve the canyon right in here. Now, Tom said, that's very interesting. That's a lot of water. And that is a lot of water. He says, but I have a question for you. He says, there's all these side canyons, especially if you go around the curve here. There's some huge side canyons coming into the Grand Canyon here that are just as steep and just as deep as the Grand Canyon. And Tom asked the ranger, the geologist, he says, what cut all those? Because there's no evidence of any water coming down there today. And the geologist said, and Tom said this guy was serious. He didn't have a smile on his face. He was deadly serious. He says, what we have is occasional thunderstorms out here in the desert. So essentially what we have is occasional trickles of water coming down these box canyons on the side. And that's what's making the side canyons. So trickles of water can make the side canyons, but it takes 92 million gallons of water per minute to carve the main canyon. Is that even logical? It's not. But I understand. He's locked in. He's locked in to look at it. Now there's good evidence today that there's actually two huge lakes actually up above the Grand Canyon. You know, at the end of the flood, Psalms 104 says, at the end of the flood, God pushed up the mountains, dropped the oceans for the basins for the water to run off in. And so, but many places we actually have evidence it looks like water was trapped. So we have the mountains coming up, water being trapped and everything. The canyon was already, not the canyon was formed, but the rock layers were already in place. And then what we have is this water trapped. At some point in time after that, what happened, we believe, is this lake. This is called the Grand Lake. This is actually the Hopi Lake right in here. One of the ideas is this, that this lake then broke, came down here. First of all, it had to remove all this rock material here, what they call the Mesozoic. We know it used to be there because we still have buttes and everything out there, but most of it, over 200 cubic miles, is wiped out. It had to be removed first. And then the water came down and began cutting the canyon, and then it cut off the right in here, took off the tip of this lake, and then this lake came down, and the combination looks like today. It's these lakes here that broke or breached and came down, and that's what's made the Grand Canyon in a short period of time. Again, time was not the key ingredient. What was the key ingredient? Have to have enough water. By the way, there is another idea than Austin that come in. It's actually We have a video of it out there. It's called The Grand Canyon, The Puzzle on the Plateau. It gives us some new information. It's kind of based on Walter Brown, but I think most of them are very close, but they have some differences in there. Very interesting DVD you might want to look at. Anyway, we have different answers, and a lot of secular geologists are actually starting to look at that as a viable thing. All right. More evidence for Mount St. Helens. When the land blew off of here and fell down in the lake, it made a wave of water, went up a mountain about 830 feet and wiped everything off in its path. Thus, it had all these trees and shrubs and everything right off the roots, and it all came back to the lake. And then over time, it's been swished back and forth through the winds. But they were actually observing. ICR was actually observing them up there. Actually, Steve Austin got some of his ideas for coal formation just by the way the bark was being peeled off these trees and everything, just by rubbing each other. But what they did observe, there was a lot of trees sticking upright out there. And over time, they were getting lower and lower water, and some of them were disappearing. They got kind of curious, and they were pretty brave to do what they did, but they actually got out there and dove on at it, and you have to be careful because this stuff's always moving and everything. But they actually found out that a lot of these trees, depending on the species of the trees, were floating vertical. What happened, it had no roots, but this would have been the root end. This was the most dense part of the tree. It was the heaviest. It was getting water saturated, and it was floating vertical. And then these things were sinking and actually embedding themselves down in the bottom of the lake. And because they've had a lot of rapid erosion up there, a lot of mud stuff being poured into this lake, they were being buried in place, standing vertical right in here. Depending on the species, some of them were horizontal, but many of them were standing vertical in there. You go up to Yellowstone National Park, what is called Specimen Ridge. There used to be a sign up on Specimen Ridge that said, these forests up here and here, there's 25 different successive forests. They counted, and each one of these forests grew for a long period of time, died off, was buried, then another forest came in and grew on top of that one. So they had 25 different forests up there, had to take lots of time. We actually know a man in Grand Junction went up to Specimen Ridge, and because of that sign, he threw away his Bible. He decided he'd no longer believe in his Bible because there was good evidence that it was an old earth, and he understood what the Bible was teaching, so he said, I just can't believe my Bible anymore. They'd taken the sign down. Why? Because of Mount St. Helens. One of the problems up here, some of the trees up there had roots, but most of the trees that are exposed have no roots. They were saying these forests grew in place, but do you know any tree that can grow without roots? Problem, isn't it, all right? And also, there was no soil layers up there. They've taken their sign down. Now they say, actually, probably what happened is what we're seeing going on in Mount St. Helens today. But unfortunately, this man threw away his faith because of a sign with a different viewpoint. We're taught that coal formed 120 to 350 million years ago, and we're just right up in here, 200 1,000 to 3 million years ago, but yet they find artifacts. So man and coal were not living at the same time, but yet they find artifacts in the coal that don't belong there. That one right there was found in coal, a coal bed, coal layer. What is it? It's a bell. It's a brass bell. Was this made by dinosaurs? We're heralding in the age of the dinosaurs. Ding dong, here we come. No. Do apes make this? Does anything other than human can make things like this? So I believe this was the people that lived before the flood. This was part of their artifacts. They got caught up in the flood, and that's what we're finding in there. Okay, it's a brass bell found in the skull. Other things found. Unfortunately, you find these things, you really need not to take it out of the coal. You need to leave it in place. Because if you take it out of the coal, even if you have the impression, it's pretty easy to try to explain away. But here's another human artifact that was found in coal. I need to talk about VARs. I've been up Alaska several different times, and I had one guy that had actually done a bunch of the coring and everything on the ice fields up there. Argue with me. He says, we know the earth is very, very old because of the varves that we find in these cores, ice things. A varve is just a layers. Two layers equal a year in these ice things is what we're told. So they'll be an ice pack. They'll drill down 10,000 feet and they'll have little special huts, and then they go in there and they count all the lines divided by two, and that gives them hundreds of thousands of years of accumulation of this ice up in here. Hundreds of thousands of years. Well, something that kind of changes that makes a little bit of a problem. Back during World War II, we had these airplanes called P-38s. They actually had a squadron flew out of, was actually heading over to England. They had made a stop up in Greenland, headed out, but about halfway between Greenland and Iceland, they ran into a major winter storm. So they turned around to try to get it back to base, but a few of them crashed right in here. Later, they came back and got their survivors and everything, hauled them off. And then later came back to try to get their airplanes back, get the parts back. But the airplanes had disappeared. A storm had come in and it buried them, and they were gone. They could not find them. They continued to search for these airplanes, and finally they found them. 48 years later, they found those airplanes using sonograms and everything. 48 years later, these airplanes were 263 feet underneath the ice. Now, what's that mean? Well, let's look at it this way. 263 feet underneath the ice, 48 years, that makes an average of just under 5.5 feet of ice accumulating on top of these each year. Right? Now, doing that, 10,000 feet at 5.5 will be only 1,824 years. Now, be careful, though, because that's using uniformitarianism, doing the rate that we observe today. But we can be slower than that if we want. Why? I believe we can go back to 4,400 years and get that deep of an ice pack. Why 4,400 or 4,500? We have good evidence that the ice age was right after the flood, at the end of the flood. So we have that much time to work with up there. It's strange, though. I watched on NOVA the other day, and a lot of scientists understand that we can get multiple layers, even within months, depending on the storm. Really, it's not a yearly thing. It's just a monthly thing. All right? But yet on NOVA, they had a guy up there. He's still counting two lines, all right, two layers per year. Right? Last one I want to leave with you. I love, you guys have one of the better caves there are down here in Carlsbad. You used to go into Carlsbad, and they'd always tell you, well, it took 2,000 years to make 1 inch down there. They've kind of changed the number, but that's been pretty standard. Most of them, that's they're saying, it takes 2,000 years to make 1 inch of stalactite or stalagmite or column right in here. That's usually what it's taught. Here's one right in here. Here's a column, 11-foot column. Comes down. It's actually a column, a stalactite that hit a stalagmite, came together. So we have a column, 11 feet. 11 feet, you translate that, that'd make it using 2,000 years to the inch. That'd make that column right there 265,000 years old to make that column. Problem was, that column was only 4 years, it was underneath this monument that was only 40 years old. All right? And where did this stuff come from? The material above, water dripping down from the monument above, and it was only 40 years. Only 40 years to make this column. Time is not the key ingredients. What's the key ingredients? Having at least enough water, but the right materials also. This was actually under the Lincoln Memorial, built in 1922. In the 60s, this picture was taken. We had 10 to 12 foot stalactites hanging from the ceiling. Again, time is not the key ingredient. Here's one of my favorite. This is actually a mine, fresh mine. They actually made this opening. It was not a cave, but it was a very wet mine. They came in there, and the huge stalactites in only 55 years. There's two men right down here, so you can give you an idea of the scale of these. Again, time is not the key ingredient. I'm going to skip over this real quick because we're really running out of time. And there's lots of different ideas. I still... this is what I still work on, Russell Humphreys. All right, but... I just want to end this real quick because we are running out of time. So how old is the Earth? Scientifically, I'm gonna pick on Mr. Jim there, all right? Jim, can you prove to me scientifically how old you are?
How old I am?
Yes. Now, I can look at you and get a relative age, young or old, okay, someplace in there. I asked science, though, Jim. Can you do a scientific? No. There really is nothing out there. Now, we can look at our teeth maybe, okay? Let's see how our teeth are one. My grandpa used to be a horse trader and race horses. I still have a picture of him with his head stuck in a horse's mouth. And he used to tell me he could tell the relative health and the relative age of a horse. Can't tell exactly how old he is just by his teeth. But you might have a problem with my friend Richard Saponik that works with us. He has 1/4 of his mouth is still baby teeth. He has a mutation. He's never lost those baby teeth. So you look in his mouth, and he's young, right? But he's 55 years old, so he's not really young. His brother is actually only 30-something, and he has half of his mouth is still baby teeth. He's never lost them. Scientifically, though, so can you show me? No, but you know the answer. He already gave it historically. Now, your wife tells me you drive a little fast. Now, this could be a rumor. I don't know. This could be a rumor. But the many times you've been pulled over by the highway patrol out here because you like to drive fast, right? What's the first thing the patrolman's going to ask you? after do you have any insurance? After you ask that, what's he going to ask? Yeah, he's going to ask for a form of identification. And on that, what is he going to read? How old you are. How did you establish that on that driver's license? What did you have to show when you got that driver's license? A birth certificate, a historical document. Here's my mama sitting next to me. Ask her. She'll tell you how old I am. Eyewitness report. See, we have ways to actually show how something old, historical. And I believe we have the best historical document there ever was written. They can tell us how old. And what is it? It's the Word of God. That's why I believe what I believe today. That's why I believe in a young earth, based on what the Word of God says in its genealogies. Because these scientific methods that I hung my hat on so strongly at one time, I found out they just absolutely are inaccurate. They do not work. And they're all based on assumptions that we cannot know. I do not have a time machine. I cannot go in the past and observe to see if these things are accurate. But we can test them and find out they don't work very well, do they? Right. So how old is Zira? You have to make up your own mind. But as for me and my house, we believe in a young 6,000-year-old earth. But it's up to you what you want to believe. But there's the evidence for you to chew or mull on. Okay? Any questions real quick?
Well, what about where it says in the Bible that an accountant is the one who reads the book and I can't remember exactly how it says it, but it is there, that to God...
Are you talking about 2 Peter? A day in Peter, 2 Peter says a day is like 1,000 years and 1,000 years like a day to the Lord. Understand, that is not pointing back to creation. Understand, you have to read that in context. It is pointing to the end times. It's showing that our God is very patient, but it has nothing to do with the days of creation. It's actually going to the end times, not into the beginning time. I didn't understand that because that's the verse I used for the day age theory for a long, long time. So, Nathan. Yeah, yeah. So, again, it depends on how you want to look at it, okay? But you have to read it in context. And when you look at that verse in context, it is definitely important to the end times, Christ's return, the end times, not the beginning of time. So it's very important to take everything in the Bible in context. That's why I'm saying that word yom, those days, you take it in context, there's no way you'll ever get that it's a long period of time. It's always a 24-hour period.
He's always the same yesterday, today, and forever. So if he's the same, and a day is as 1,000 years back then, or in the future, why would it not be in the past?
Well, if you look at that verse, so it's really talking about God's great patience, that he's kind of waiting on us. But understand, God is not limited to time like we are. Time is for our benefit, it's not for his. He is eternal. He's always been here. He always will be. So it's really hard to link. Terry probably has an answer to that.
It's actually a figure of speech. It's not really the definition of the day, but it's a figure of speech that's being used in that. But the other problem is, even if they had 1,000 years per day, that still doesn't give them many billions of years.
Right. And
but
I agree with you.
And one of my, I shared this yesterday, one of my problems is when I was looking at the days of creation, when I used to believe each of those days were a long period of time, we have the plants created on day number 3, and I was always thinking at least a minimum of 1,000 years using that verse, and the sun doesn't come along until day number 4, I've got a problem, because the plant needs the sun, the energy from the sun for photosynthesis so it can live. So a plant has to wait around for 1,000 years, then it's going to go through a 1,000 years. See, it's a period of light and dark, so now we have another 1,000 years of dark, so maybe, you know, it can wait 1,000, but no. They'd never make it. So that was one of the major problems for me that for the day age was the days of creation went against it.
I had always thought that verse was kind of to give you an idea of, like, to kind of help you understand, like, what eternity is and, like, how God is kind of outside of time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like, I don't know, I guess to help us understand, like, what eternity is. Not necessarily, you know, I didn't think it was really talking about, like, you know, how long a day is or anything. But.
Right. To me, in context, it's looking that our God, he would desire that nobody would go to a hell, that everyone might be saved, and he has enough patience that he's hanging on. for that. He has great, great patience, and he's still, I mean, really, as wicked as we are now, he should have shut us down right now, but he's a God that wants to give us a second chance. And so you're right, it's not like it's defining a day.
Where's the Delta of Illuvium from the Grand Canyon?
It's down in the Baja. That was always a problem, too. One of the things they do find out in the desert out there, they find huge boulders that are about half, well, about a quarter of the size of this sanctuary right in here that are out in the desert, just out there in the desert. But they can actually correlate them back that they actually came out of the Grand Canyon. Now, here's the problem. Slow and gradual erosion. How are they going to get this? These things are bigger than most dump trucks. How are they going to get these things scattered out in the desert? But we know that water moving rapidly and fast can move vast amounts of very large things in a short period of time. When, I forget, was back in the late 80s or something, when Lake Powell actually filled up and was going overflow, so they opened up the side tubes, let it out. The whole dam started shaking and trembling. They had to shut the spillways of the side off. They came in there, and through cavitation, it was taking concrete that, do you remember how thick it was, Jim? It was, Terry? It was like, it was 6 to 12 foot. Yeah, 6 foot reinforced concrete. It was plucking up, and huge, huge chunks of this stuff we shot out the end of these tubes and everything. And it was all because of a cavitation-type process with water moving very rapidly. Water moving rapidly has tremendous power. Tremendous power.
You talked about the carbon in the layers, but a fossil, by definition, doesn't have any carbon in it, right? I mean,
a fossil, by definition, is a rock. Yeah.
So when you talked previously, you kept saying bones, but you really just...
I mean, if I get bones and fossils, I interject them quite a bit.
But you did mention that some DNA had been found. So do they actually, can they find some fossils that do have some actual bones left in them?
I found in Grand Junction, myself right upside, I found petrified wood. I picked up, and it was stone on one side, but it was rotten. It was still organic material in the sun. So that section of it. By the way, Marilyn and I were in the Smithsonian several years ago, and they had a volunteer going through talking about the dinosaur section, and we just kind of sidled up and listened. And the volunteer, and they were just teaching what they were taught to teach. She says, we know how long ago the dinosaurs died because they tested them using carbon-14. I just about had a heart attack. But see, that...
I think most people think that.
Yeah, it's thrown out there. You know, if you tell a lie enough, people start to believe it. They really will. And unfortunately, evolution is being taught as truth, even though it's a lie, but it is truth is what it's being taught. And these things are thrown out there just willy-nilly, and... they're on TV everywhere, and if you keep hearing them enough, pretty soon you start to believe in it. The dating, I can't believe, even a cooking show. I was watching a cooking show, a Chinese guy, and he was getting ready to do some peas and everything, and he started explaining to me how these peas had evolved from something else. And I thought, man, you can't get away from it. You cannot get away from it. So there's a lot of misinformation out there. And you know, I use the word scientist a lot tonight, and I'm all for science. I am a scientist myself. It's the operational science. I mean, man, we praise God for science. He made our life easier using science to get to the, you know, just everything in this building. Today, I had to turn on my air conditioner. Praise God for science that can tell me how to do an air conditioner, right? But there's a, when we get into the historical section here, when we do the guessing and the world view, and I still contend that evolution is one of Satan's, one of his main methods to turn us away from God. Same method he used from the beginning with Eve. He said, did God really say? So he makes us doubt the word of God. Then he turns right around and lies. If you eat of this tree, you'll be like God yourself. So he uses the two methods in the past with Eve to deceive her and fool her. Right? Make her doubt the word of God and then lie. And what do we see today? Evolution is making us doubt the word of God, and it's based on a lie. Same method. Alright, just a little bit of change in format, but it's the same thing. I attribute evolution to Satan himself. I really do. any means he can get. And when we look at the statistics, how many of our students are being turned away because of evolution? I shared with you Sunday morning, 75% of the students that come out of the church go to the universities and colleges, 75% of them will turn away from God. The number one reason given is evolution. It's happening even to kids before they leave. What's the book that came out here recently? Yeah, already gone. And I think what statistics, 60% of the kids that are still sitting in the pews today attending, we're talking about high school, junior high kids have already turned from, even though they're sitting in the pews. And the number one reason to give, you look at the background, is evolution. The world's full of it out there. The kids are not safe. In schools, public schools teach it, mandate it. Not all teachers teach it, but every school district demands that it be taught. It's a national standard anymore. And you go to movies, it's promoted, you look at the magazines, you look at the newspapers. I don't know about your newspapers here, but we have the Daily Sentinel of Grand Junction. And every week there's new proofs for evolution. I mean, they're very much behind evolution, so they like to promote it. It's everywhere. And our kids are exposed to this all the time. Even kids that are going to Christian schools are exposed to this stuff. They're in a spiritual battle. And that's why we need to pray for our kids, but we also need to instruct them. So, like this little girl, she knows, all right? She knows that's a pig too. She's not going to be fooled by stuff like that.